Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
I think creativity is like a phenotype for consciousness. It's something that's the expression of it that other people see.
Stand by, I'll be right there.
Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 364. Today is Sunday, the 15th of March, 2020. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast. Thanks for taking the time out of your so busy day to listen to this episode. And please rate us if you like the show and don't forget to subscribe to catch all of the next episodes. On to this week's interview, which is with Dr. Sharma Raman. Sharma is an accomplished musician, vocalist, songwriter, with a PhD in philosophy, neuroscience, and complexity. She has founded several initiatives, including Jugular Productions, Deep Science Ventures, and NeuroCreate, of which she is CEO. In this conversation with Sharma, we discuss her pluridisciplinary approach, the concept and process of creativity viewed through neuroscience, how to get into the flow state of mind, what her startup NeuroCreate is setting out to achieve, and the role of AI and tech within creativity. You'll find all the show notes on minterdial.com. Now for the interview. So Dr. Sharma Raman, great to have you on the show. I got a chance to listen to you at an event called the Creative Futures, and we're looking at creativity, technology, and the future of such. You were brilliant on the panel, and so I wanted to get you on the show. So in a few words, how about describing who you are, Dr. Sharma?
I'm really glad you said who I was rather than what I was. I can tell you my nationality in the sense that I have Bengali parents from Bangladesh. I was born in United Arab Emirates and I have lived in England for the last 20 years. So now that's over. The things I'm interested in are science, art, technology, sociology, philosophy, and how all these things kind of link to each other and come together.
Well, so you have a YouTube channel that features your singing, your artistry, your musician. You've also got a PhD in neuroscience. That's a wicked combination. How on earth do you manage both of those?
I resented the British education system, to put it lightly, when I got to A-level, where they wanted me to choose to either be an artist or a scientist. So obviously, I rebelliously carried on the artistry and went and did, you know, the expected thing formally, which was a more scientific route. But then I really got to a crossroads when I finished my bachelor's and my master's and, you know, I really want to try this music thing. I really want to try this, you know, acting thing. I feel like it's now bursting out and I can't ignore it any longer type thing.
So you're in your white suit and there you are wishing, you're tapping along to music, Capital Radio.
Do you know what? That's really interesting. I was in the basement. You're not far off. I was in the basement during my bachelor's thesis where I was looking at fruit flies and I was sorting them out based on like the color of their eyes and how curly their wings were. And all I was listening to, as one does, because I'd somehow genetically modified them as well. Don't shoot me. Anyway, and I was listening to Mr. Scruff and getting into a rhythm doing that. So you're not a million miles away. And I used to put on a lot of music events when I was at uni. I was a radio DJ. I was a head of marketing of that radio station as well. It was at the time, if you guys know UCL, it was Rare FM. It was Europe's largest internet radio station. And I think, you know, at some point I was like, I think I want to be the person on the stage and not the person just maybe enabling it. I still do a lot of that, but I am that person who's composing, and it's always coming out of me. So I thought, okay, let's try it. But then, you know, I also didn't want to give up the science. So I thought, what if I created a whole new subject area, which at the time it was, and now it's really trendy. Let's look at the science of creativity. And this is where I thought, I'm just going to marry the two things together, and I don't have to choose. Like, my whole life has been about not having to choose, you know?
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, absolutely is. My observation is many people in business putting on that quote-unquote white lab coat have a side hustle. And they're like, oh, I wish I could play music because, you know, if I could make money playing music or if I could do the thing I'm really passionate about, I just have to work. But it seems like for you, you've managed to put them together and they're both juicy and, well, I'm both, I say, multiply interesting to you.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that each thing feeds into the other. So, like, you know, if I didn't have firsthand practice-based experience of creative thinking or creative activities or, you know, have that ability to compose or perform, you know, if I didn't have that sort of, you know, firsthand experience to it, I don't think I would have been able to even create the experiments within the scientific inquiry of them so that I could actually even, you know, collect data that was even meaningful, right? Because, I mean, there's a lot of scientific experiments that are done in isolation where you get one person doing something really quite artificial and strange and just what we call not ecologically valid, put it that way. So I had to find ways of allowing people to feel really comfortable to be creative so that I could actually explore their brain activity whilst they're being creative rather being like, right, you have 30 seconds, go be creative, monkey. Like, you know, I couldn't do that because I'm like, that would be a travesty to me as a performer. Right. So why would I do that to somebody else, you know? So, yeah, the long-winded way of saying, I think these two things or these multiple things have always fed into each other for me.
So I'm guessing that you paid quite a lot of attention to the operation that was done on a woman who had a big cancer in her head, and she was a violinist, and
that's
she
really
was playing.
Scary. Yeah, I literally read about it yesterday. That's really funny. Yay, I like synchronicities.
I thought that was fascinating. So you have founded, if I understand correctly, NeuroCreate, and I'd love to know about what this enterprise is trying to achieve, set out to achieve.
Mm-hmm. To do that, I'm going to take you back one step again to the PhD that you mentioned. So my PhD was an interdisciplinary PhD because we were looking at the neuroscience of creative thinking, different types of creativity, the different stages and processes and toolkits that you might need to be creative, different sort of innovation frameworks. This all might sound like gobbledygook to people, you know, they'd be like, you know, creativity is just creativity. How can you break it down? But you can. And the reason I actually went into it was because I was interested in consciousness, as you do. Mm-hmm. And everybody went, that's career death. You don't do that now. Mm-hmm. Go and philosophize about that at the end.
How you make money on that.
Exactly. So then I was like, okay, but really, what am I interested in? I think I'm interested in how you make something from nothing. Say that's what it magically or mystically looks like when you think about creativity. But then actually, this is something you can examine as a process. So I've mentioned this before. I think creativity is like a phenotype for consciousness. It's something that's the expression of it that other people see, you know? So bearing that in mind, why the neuroscience of it? There have been a lot of mental models that have been, you know, proposed for creative thinking, lots of philosophical thought models, you know, lots of people who've done computational, you know, creative algorithms where they've gone, I think this is how the human works, and let's see if the output of the machine actually matches the output of the human, you know? Mm-hmm. And then people have done a lot of, like, interview-based stuff, you know, to do use cases and be like, okay, I think, broadly speaking, this is the process that, say, Einstein might have gone through, but actually look quite similar to, say, maybe what, you know, a fine artist or a musician might have gone through, you know? So my job was like, okay, this is all brilliant, but what's the one ring that binds it all? And could that be the physiology? Is there a physiological marker, you know, that actually underpins any of these things? Or is it forever going to be a qualitative, subjective space?
So you say you're trying to find a unifying concept to creativity?
Well, more kind of to see if there's any biomarkers to these different states of mind that happen within creative thinking, or, you know, how we use our mind differently. So it's what you call cognition. Right. Mm-hmm. Is there creative cognition? Right. Does creative cognition have some sort of signature pattern when it's in these different spaces in our minds?
So a couple of things. First of all, I'm thinking of as opposed to cognitive, there's sort of affective or emotional creativity. And the second thing I was wondering about when you described a creativity as something from nothing. You can also imagine creativity at the outer limb of something that's already created.
Absolutely.
And so an addition to something. And so there are many ways that you can apply creativity. It doesn't have to be on a white sheet.
Absolutely. So that's exactly, I mean, the reason I said that rather provocatively is like that could be what it appears like, right? Suddenly you have something and then, you know, a few minutes ago you didn't. And, you know, sometimes even creatives, quote unquote, you know, go, I don't know how I did that. It just happened, you know, it's this crazy synthesis and it's magic, you know? And then you were like, nah, it came from some other thing, right? You're standing on the shoulders of giants and, or your own shoulders, if you might consider it, maybe like 20 years ago, and suddenly the idea came up again. So why don't we break it down into concepts and, you know, these being the sort of the building blocks of thought and how they kind of come together. And so what we're doing with NeuroCreate, let's go back. I, during my PhD, found a pattern within the brain activity of the musicians that I was looking at that corresponded to a mental state called flow. And flow is a mental state that was coined by a positive psychologist called Csikszentmihalyi. And he was trying to look for happiness, I suppose, and what made people happy, which is a really, really huge endeavor and super culturally biased and individual, and you know, but what he did find were like a collection of traits that seem to go together, and one of those things is being super engaged in what you're doing, transformation of time, the ability for you to change your strategy very flexibly, so not get fixated. The exact opposite of that obviously is stress. And that's when you can only see things in one way, or fear. That's called functional fixedness. Mm-hmm. So flow is the opposite of that. So what I mean by that is like if I showed you like a bottle and I got you to try and think about other uses of a bottle apart from a bottle, can you just kind of think about it as a completely different structure? If you're stressed, probably not. You'd be like, no, it's a bottle, goddammit.
And babies are able to do that so much easier sometimes than we are.
Yeah, so maybe the baby will try and roll on it like a log, right? Or something like that, right? So that's mental flexibility that comes with flow, but also the ability to see the bigger picture as well as the details. So say, you know, you're a musician, you need to know what you're playing, what your band members are playing, and how the audience is like receiving it if you're, you know, doing your thing well, right? Same thing maybe with a footballer, or same thing if you're like, I don't know, doing some public speaking, you know? You have to kind of know what you're about to say, whether whatever you just did had an effect and, you know.
Are you present?
So it's actually a temporal thing as well. You're absolutely right. So past, present, future have to be, you know, together. And the coolest thing is people say that they feel really happy. So that's where it comes back to that positive psychology thing. Now, the interesting thing about flow is that it can happen in any type of work that you do, as long as you're passionate about that work and you have some skills to be able to do that. Why? Because it happens basically when it's at a sweet spot of your ability to meet a challenge. So if it's too easy, you get bored. If it's too hard, you just get frustrated. So if you can do this in any work, it means you can also do it in creative work. Mm-hmm. So
assuming you're good at least you
have some base level of you know, fundamental skills, right? Mm-hmm. So we're like, okay, so what is NeuroCreate doing? We're basically creating digital collaborators, which are enabled by AI to help train you in creative thinking, to help spark creative ideas and thought in order to take you through the different stages of creativity to lead you up to the creative flow state. So essentially, we want to help you get to flow.
All right. So I'm sure you did it to your own brain, Shama, while you were playing music. I'm sure that must have been really fun. I would love to do that. side note. How do you measure the state of flow of somebody? So, you know, you imagine you're trying to help me be more creative, and you're going to attach nodes to my head?
I did when it was, you know, in a lab, and it was like a swimming cap with 64 electrodes. So, which is like great because I'm able to get a lot of data at super nice resolution, you know, because you have 64 electrodes on the top of your head. So, yeah, exactly. But obviously not when this is like, you know, a product that anybody wants to use, right? It has to be nice and simple. So at the moment we have wearables called Fitbits, for example. Sure. That's for your heart rate mostly. But, you know, you'd be surprised to know there are also wearables for your brain. And there are companies out there who are creating it to help you sleep better, to help you meditate, you know. So those are hardware companies. And what we want to do is create the software that can be like agnostic to any one of these sort of wearables. So the idea would be that, you know, we currently have deep learning models that can detect from, you know, this sort of live streaming of your brain activity, whether you're in that flow state or not. Which what we then want to do is link that back up to our creative thinking tool to actually really personalize how we can help you, you know, get to your next cool idea. So you want to augment that whole process. You want to enhance it. You want to be playful with it. You know, people say it can be quite frustrating when you're trying to come up with the coolest idea, but, you know, why does it have to be? So we're trying to help visualize your thinking. It's a thinking tool, basically.
So in essence, whatever this hardware is, how many senses do you need to really at least get some kind of understanding of flow? Because, I mean, if you have 64 sensors, I'm going to imagine it's a little bit more precise. If I have five, can I get there?
That's what we're working on at the moment. And so far, we've got really high accuracy rates. So, you know, there's some wearables out there which has only four sensors, or some which have 14. Depends on, you know, how cyber you want to look.
And is there, what is the correlation between flow and heartbeat? Heart rate. I mean, I don't know. There's rate.
Heart rate variability, I would say.
That's what they have to look at, that sort of the interspace.
Yeah. So this is what we're looking at the moment, actually, because it's not a simple... exactly. So heart rate is just basically the number of times something like your heart beats exactly in a minute. The heart rate variability is the space between the beats. Exactly. And, you know, an intuitive thing might be, oh, they should be really even, right? Because if they're not, you're obviously going into some sort of panic mode or whatever, right? Actually, counterintuitively, we have a very variable inter-heartbeat interval because it allows us to be on our toes and respond to, you know, I don't know, the lion around the corner.
So I've just purchased the Apple Watch 5
right.
with the EEG, and I'm wondering to
ECG.
What ECG, sorry. Oh, yeah, EEG is on the head.
Yeah.
Sorry. And what extent that is accurate to your reading, because it's a consumer product. And
yeah.
Are there better ones out there? And what's your reading?
There are other ECG, you know, wearables as well. So the difference, I guess, with the ECG and heart rate variability is one of more data, basically. So with the Apple Watch, if I'm correct, you also have to basically
hold it,
yeah, and on the crown, right?
Yeah,
that sort of thing.
Exactly.
So the reason I was mentioning the difference, say, between heartbeat and the counterintuitiveness of heart rate variability, you might go, oh, do you know what? The faster or, you know, the shorter amount of time between the intervals, that might just mean that I'm more excited and I'm more stressed. Or the other way around would mean I'm more relaxed, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too much information to go off of. And it's kind of the same problem when you're just like, oh, you know what? Anything that makes you excitable, but what does excitable mean? It could mean fear, it could mean angry, it could mean happy, right? Whereas with the brain, you have a lot more nuances that you can see because the data is more complex. So if you look at the EEG as the ground truth, you can then start correlating it with these other things. So
using
from
AI, presumably.
Exactly. So from there, yes, we're now trying to see that link with heart rate variability. Reason being, like, you know, what we want to do is, you know, not necessarily rely on all these wearables. We actually want our platform to start looking at behaviors of how you interact with some, you know, something that's digital. Because, you know, maybe you don't want to wear a heart rate variability or ECG Apple Watch. And maybe you don't want to wear a wearable brain sensing headband.
Right, so I, of course, being an athlete, there have been times when I feel so in the flow, and like every ball I'm hitting in tennis, it looks huge, and I see it on the strings, and there's that flow element, or when I'm dancing to the dead. How does one procure the flow, state of flow? No, it's the Grateful Dead.
Oh, damn it. Okay. sorry.
We were talking about that before.
What was your question again?
So how do you create the state of flow? I mean, other than, you know, taking psychedelics or something, perhaps, what are the ways that in business people can, as they're going into, let's say, a brainstorming session or a strategic session, and you want to get to that flow, what are the kinds of things you can do to establish that? I mean, if do you have to be passionate? Do you have to be engaged beforehand? Or is that what you need to do as a precondition? I mean, what do you have to? How do you get into that state of flow in business?
So, like I was saying, you can get into flow in anything that you're passionate and skilled at. So there's probably as many ways of getting into flow as there are professions in the world.
But then, so if you're in a business, let's say you're going to approach a business team, we're a group of 15 people around the table. We love our business, you know, more or less passionate about it. How does one get a group into a state of flow?
I think it depends on the activity. So we're just, you know, choosing one path. So our path is, why don't we do, instead of, say, playing tennis, because not everybody, say, is a tennis player, or, say, I'm a musician, nobody necessarily, you know, has those motor skills necessarily in the business, say. We kind of went, okay, let's look at the fact that most people are, you know, what we call in the knowledge sector, they're thought workers, right? Everybody's essentially, like you said, they're strategizing, they're coming up with new ideas. So most people brainstorm, or another way of calling it apparently these days is thought storming, right? Most people will do something called conceptualizing, right? They will just kind of go, right, well, here's an idea. I want to invert it. I want to look at it from different angles. I want to explore it.
Out of the box.
Yeah, I want to look at it, you know, thinking at it laterally, say. I want to be able to do the creative exploration, the research of it. I want to also then, you know, let my mind cogitate and, you know, find the patterns that it needs to find in order to get to the eureka moment. And then I want to implement that eureka moment, and that's when flow comes in. So do you see what I mean by there's many stages to creativity, and there's also many different tools that you could use within each of those stages. And so what we're doing is we're digitizing this, these stages in a framework that's really flexible, that you can use in whichever order that you want. Doesn't have to be in, you know, I must do exploration before I do analysis, right? Could be in whatever order you want. But it's also digitizing a lot of these tools. So, for example, there's a design thinking tool, which actually is from the business world, Edward de Bono's Six Hats, for example. So we're utilizing that. So we're like, okay, here's a concept. I'm in a business of making bottles. I don't know why I'm interested in bottles today. But anyway, so why don't we look at bottles from more than just the normal angle that I look at it at? So the reason that we're using AI is that we've created these really big semantic knowledge graphs that have been taken from things like culture, lifestyle, and trends on one hand. For innovation, it's been trained on 35 million different sources of things to do with architecture, design, tech, science, engineering. We've also got experience in games design, because then it starts, you know, basically bringing in associations from the greater pool of your industry rather than just your team. So what it helps is it brings in, you know, wider than that room. It helps with diversity of thought. It helps against groupthink, which apparently is a big deal, right? Because, you know, if it's your company,
especially if the boss is in the room.
Well, exactly. If it's your company, you've probably been looking at bottles for like God knows how long, and there's only one way that you look at bottles by now, right? And
instead of rolling on them.
Exactly. Instead of rolling on them. Exactly that. So what we're talking about is mental flexibility. That was one of our first ways that we're trying to get you into that flow state by using these design thinking tools. So what the AI allows allows is that it's constantly interacting with you. So it's really interactive. And I think that's something that can keep challenging you. And it is, we deliberately chose things to challenge you in order to keep you on your toes.
Well, I want to push back 1 second and say, well, first of all, in order for, if I put in the word bottle, something like rocket comes up. So it's quite distant, you know, like a creative thought. I'm guessing that tagging has to be an extraordinarily important way toward to get the bottle to rocket. Or how does that work?
No, at this point, we're more looking at creating corpuses. So corpus means a whole body that the training is done on. So a body of digital sources. We're using natural language processing. So we're creating, like I was saying, like pools. So if one pool is about culture, lifestyle, and trends, probably bottle will not come up a rocket. But say if one pool is about innovation and I've sat there and gone, you know, there's engineering and physics in here, maybe it will come up with rocket. Mm-hmm. So just to give you that example.
And big word for me is chaos. Mm-hmm. And one, I tend to somehow, in Minter's mind, link creativity with chaos. Because otherwise, out of the box seems like we're just on giant shoulders. Mm. This notion of introducing chaos and the ability for a machine, perhaps quantically, able to generate a chaotically different, therefore pushing the boundaries of what our connections are doing in our brain.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how that goes.
I think there's a scale. So there's actually, I forgot what it was called, but there was a scale of creative acceptability where it's almost Gaussian in the sense that if you go a little bit out of the box, most people go, yeah, that's cool. If you go quite a bit out of the box, they might go, oh, that's pretty like revolutionary. If you go super out of the box, they're like, that's crazy, not doing it, not going to accept it. Right. So it kind of
there's that groupthink as well that really cuts down on that. Sort of
thing. But also, like, you know, you think about, you know, all those like artists who are only like recognized posthumously, right? They're way too crazy at the time, right? So it kind of depends what sort of creative crazy you want to go, right? So we're kind of allowing a lot of those sort of nuances. So the first sort of suggestions we might give you are like just like semantic or meaningful or, you know, cultural or innovational, you know, associations from the wider world of that, you know, industry. But then we can bring in some lateral thinking, which is like, actually, now we're really broadening out the concept space. Now we're really going further afield. And then we've also got a randomizer. So that's the element of like, okay, you chaos. Know what? Yeah, chaos.
We're not there yet, I'm guessing, because chaos is a hard thing to actually create or random, total randomness. They say that's the domain of quantum computing. I'm guessing people who are listening to this will be thinking about artificial intelligence and creativity. So what is Shama's opinion about the ability for AI to be creative?
Okay, one sec.
Some fresh water from visual.
I've obviously been looking at this fresh water bottle. Now you know where my references are coming from. What is my so I often give like a talk on this, which is, yeah, where do we put the word creative next to AI? Do we say creative AI? Do we say AI assisted creativity? Do we say, I don't know, automated AI for decision making? Okay, the creativity wasn't in that word, you know, sort of thing. But it's like, you know, at what stage in the process of creativity are you using AI? So I think that's important to think about. 'Cause, yeah, you know, you can have AI that can literally automate millions of website layouts, for example. Or millions
and
of...
One of them might be the creative solution, but all of them won't necessarily be creative.
Well, those are, I think, just different. It's just the ability of it to automatedly, you know, play around with different layouts. And then it's up to you to kind of go, oh, I think I want this one. That's just, I think, something that's a decision-making process, you know? Similarly, like, you know, you might be, if in graphic design, whatever, you might just be like, you know, should it be blue? Should it be red? Should it be on the top right corner? Should it be, you know? All these sorts of things, which might have taken a long, long, long time if you did it, you know, individually yourself. This is where AI would really expedite that. And then you just move on to the more interesting stuff, you know. And then there's actual creative AI where they're, you know, I'm sure you've heard about this ad nauseum, like GANs, for example, right? Google deep dream. I saw the tweet that you did. This is pretty cool.
Spooky.
Yeah, really spooky.
I'll add that to the show notes.
Yeah. You know, and that's where people are like, okay, so it's generating something from nothing. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, it's not from nothing, is it? It's just, it's been fed millions and millions of, you know, yeah, exactly, for photos of birds and animals and whatever it is. And then it's trying to synthesize something, mm-hmm. which could be a bit of a mirror into our own creative process, mm-hmm. you know, a bit more. Or, you know, AI that's creating new styles of painting, for example. You know, which some people find really like bland, and they would just, I don't know, have prints of it and put it up on their, you know, their living room walls or something. Mm. Or other people would be like, actually, that's quite interesting. It's a different thing, you know.
Well, so one has a tendency to say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Exactly. Can we say the same thing about creativity? And how do these markers appear? I mean, if my brain has none of these markers, what right do I have to say that is creative? Mm.
In what sense, sorry?
Well, if I see something and says, well, that's not, that orange handle on the store is not creative.
Yeah.
And you look at my, you scan 64 points and I have zero markers on my brain.
Right.
So you would tend to say, well, he's not creative, so he's not allowed to give a judgment.
Right.
So, I mean, I could imagine that, because the eye of the beholder. So if the eye of the beholder is not mm-hmm. creative, what mm-hmm. right do I have to judge creativity? Because we're in a business mode and we're trying to be more creative. We're trying to generate a more creative solution. Some people are more prone to it than others. And then the way that they connect dots, for example, and relate one idea to another.
I think you have to break down your question a bit more.
All right. So if I see something creative, we say the creativity is in the eye of the beholder. Mm-hmm. I think that's creative. I don't think that's creative. Mm-hmm. How can you judge the ability of creativity in a brain? Is there a way for us to understand a brain's ability to judge creativity, put it that way?
Okay, so now you're talking about the judger rather than the creator.
That's correct.
Right, okay, cool. So like, I suppose there's a lot of store to be put on expertise. So mm-hmm. for example, if you said the door in orange, it could be like other designers, for example, or architects, or you know, people in the craft of that thing, where you might want to sort of look at their judgment on something. You might get a little bit broader, so it's not just architects and designers. It could be, I don't know.
Well, if, as soon as I told you that was David Hockney's mm-hmm. door handle, then yeah. of course you're going to say, well, I know who he is, and therefore it must be amazingly interesting. And then that'll right. precondition you. So, because I mean,
he's a photographer, so that's a little bit wider than... visual yeah. Artist versus, say, somebody who designs door handles.
Right.
So well, that's broader again. So that's kind of interesting, but sort of in the same space.
Well,
so.
What I was getting at was if I'm an intellectual person, but I don't have creativity, can I participate in the creative mode? Because in a business, the way it works is mm-hmm. if the highest paid person in the room, the CEO, is not a creative person, but it's just all about the number, get it
yeah.
in. And you're like, I got this new idea, it looks like that. And then the guy says, you know, I don't like it. And well, actually, you have no right to say that except the fact that you're the highest paid person
yeah.
in the room.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, I have nothing more to add to that.
It's a thought.
No, I mean, okay. The way that, if you're asking specifically what I did in my actual PhD, you could be the seventh person to actually read it. So I could send you that. It's a very philosophical question, like what is creativity, right? So then we thought, you know, one way could be to have a tripartite way of looking at it, right? So one thing would be a self-assessment. So did I myself think that what I created was creative? Mm-hmm. One way would be an objective assessment. And an objective assessment would be judges, right? Now, that wouldn't be just one judge because that's not really valid. In psychology, say that it should be a minimum of three, mm-hmm. right? We had five, right? And it was in music, and we were looking at jazz and classical, so we had to have a mixture of jazz and classical.
Yeah, because if it's already been done before, then mm-hmm. surely that's not creative. And in order to know that, mm-hmm. you have to have been there.
Yeah. And so, for example, nowadays, people are not used to improvising on classical music. which is quite interesting, I found out, because it's a pedagogical divide. But back in the day of Mozart, it was quite common. So that's quite interesting, because Mozart actually used to build that into his symphonies.
Like the fame in the film, Amadeus says, would you like, how many, you have too many notes? Would you like me to take out these ones? And he improvised this brilliant piece in the film.
Exactly. And so we did find that there was a bias amongst the judges to be able to even try and judge classical improvisation. And obviously, the jazz people like the jazz things better and the classical people like the classical things better. So we did have to correct for those biases to normalize them, right? So there are things you can do to look at that. Now, if I then went and... so those are two things. The other thing was, actually, do I see a consistent brain pattern when either one of these,
groups,
are saying that something is creative? Mm-hmm. And also, it's not binary. We didn't just say it's creative or it's not creative. We gave them a scale between 1 to 5, mm-hmm. right? And so it's not completely continuous, but at least it's a bit more graded. Now, if there was agreement in either 2 or 3 out of 3, then we're on to something, right? And so what I found actually was the self-assessment wasn't very good, but the objective assessment was, and it did actually correspond to a consistent brain pattern every time.
Wow. So you're actually looking at the brain, seeing what's happened at the moment when they observe something and say, that's really creative, that's a 5 out of mm-hmm. 5. Mm-hmm. And then you're trying to correlate that. And then if 3 of them are having this, 3 or more are having the same thing, then you're talking about, then you're augmenting real creativity.
Well, I mean, so for example, we'd get, say, the average of the judges, mm-hmm. right? And then we'd have the person's self-assessment, and then we'd have the brain activity. So for example, if I had found that the brain activity correlated to a self-assessment, okay, that's interesting. So maybe it's a subjective state of mind, right? Mm-hmm. If I then found that actually the brain activity corresponded to just whatever the judge's collective, decision was, you're like, oh, wait, that's kind of interesting, because that's an objective thing. And whether you know it or not, your brain has it's geared into or shifted into a modus operandi that's allowing you to perform at this level, mm-hmm. right? And then if you found that all three sort of things matched up, you're probably in some sort of nirvana where everybody is super self-aware and always knows that, what they did was creative or was crap, essentially.
Well, is there not a possibility, though, that as the group gets synchronized, they might be doing it over a period of time, they start getting aware of the signals that they're having amongst each other, and there's a sort of, could groupthink then reestablish itself within that, as if the group is the same group all the time?
Well, actually, so again, two questions, right? If you're talking about my PhD experiment, they were all randomized. Nobody was in the same room as each other, mm-hmm. so there's no possibility of that. Mm-hmm. And the way that the performances were done were also in randomized order. It's precisely to combat this, basically. Mm-hmm. It was what they call familiarization almost, right? Mm-hmm. So you don't want things in the same order, and you don't want people in the same room mm-hmm. doing that sort of thing. Now, if you're talking about the situation, again, we're talking about the brainstorming, and mm-hmm. we're talking about the business mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Yeah, that's the problem. So if you have the same group of people always trying to brainstorm about the same thing, mm-hmm. then I don't necessarily see where you're going to find the new thing mm-hmm. in that. So I think, when people get a bit scared of what AI could mean for creative processes right. or for anything like that, it's not that everything that humans are doing are amazing, right? So actually the AI doesn't have to be like the human, and the AI isn't about replacing the human. What if the AI can just bring in an offbeat sparker or stimulus to actually get you out of that group thing?
Augmenting creativity.
Totally. And that's the design that we're coming at it from. So, yeah.
So I wanted to just spend one last moment on, Shama, on something you mentioned in another podcast, which really got my goat, which is that when people listen to music, their heartbeats will tend to synchronize. Mm. And he was suggesting that would be a route to empathy. So I would love for you to describe that, because that's something I'm interested in.
So before having NeuroCreate during my PhD and also kind of now as well, I have a art science creative production agency called Jugular Productions. And why jugular is a vein that joins the heart and the head. So what we were trying to do is essentially link up really heady intellectual academic stuff that never necessarily leaves the lab, but is super interesting to matters of the heart. What does that that mean? Visceral lived experience. And why would people even give a damn about this sort of stuff, right? So we tried to do it through performance, workshops, talks, embodied experiences. And there was a piece of research that actually said that those who sing together synchronize. And so it's actually more active than listening to music. So jury was a little bit out as to why that happened. It could be because they're singing in a choir together, for they're, you know, they're taking the breath at the same time. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, their sort of heartbeat synchronized when they sing. There's another piece of research that showed that actually synchronizing biorhythms was the basis of group empathy. And yet another piece of research that showed that actually music was one of the, well, is the first technology we ever created, and specifically rhythms. So it was actually a format of getting people on the same page.
Yeah, so you mentioned biorhythms and rhythms. Are they the same, and how? What's the correlation or link between those two?
You can entrain your biorhythms from external rhythms. So what does that mean? We have a heartbeat. That's the most you know, obvious biorhythm that we have. Obviously, you have heart, you know, the brain, that's very, very complex rhythms that are happening there. You might have, you know, the rate of breathing that you have. Maybe it's the blood that's pumping. There's all sorts of rhythms in your body. There's also tiny, minuscule molecular ones. Like, there's all sorts of things. It's a huge system, very complex, all interlinks, right? And curiously,
and your circadian rhythm too.
There is a circadian rhythm, and you did mention that. Actually, I'll come back to that. When you said business people, we'll come back to that in a second. So something like music, which has this sort of, you know, might have some pounding rhythm if it's not classical, say, you know, that after a while you will actually see that showing up as an entrainment. You know, whether it's in your heart or whether it's in certain sort of rhythms in your brain as well. And there's other startups that are working on that as well. Mm. And so what we did in that experiment, it was a social experiment where we didn't know what the outcome was going to be, but we thought it'd be really fun to link these two bits of research together. Mm-hmm. Because what I wanted was a big love experience at the end of our event, so that everybody would go, yeah, we loved it, want to come back.
I just imagine this in a business context. Ooh.
Yeah, big loving, basically. So yeah, well, I mean, the whole thing was like, all right, so we took the pulse of one of the members of the audience, and we set that as the tempo for the music that then ensued, and then we got people to actually sing to that music, and in some of the later versions of this, we got people to stand up and actually move to the music, and that was actually the most strongest sort of, you know, correlation. Mm-hmm. Well, then after a period of time, we then stopped, and then we used our phones, because they have something called a pulse oximeter, most of them at the back of it. Mm-hmm. Where you put your finger on it, you can actually see what your BPM is for mm-hmm. your heart. And we found that every single person had basically either 127 or 128 BPM, mm-hmm. Like really synchronized for like a group of 40 people, right? And then
different ages?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. And then, you know, the composer that we were like working with towards the end, because he actually set the music to that original person's pulse, mm-hmm. was like, do you want to know what the BPM of the piece was? Or like, yeah, sure. Wow, this is a double blind study, like without even trying, you mm-hmm. know? And he was like, yeah, 128 BPM. Wow. So that's quite interesting. And we asked people, how do you feel? And they're like, yeah, great. Okay, cool.
This is the idea of group empathy then.
Basically, yeah. And then you mentioned circadian rhythm. So in addition to, say, like maybe, you know, using our brainstorming tool in a, you know, like a conceptualization task or activity, what might be quite interesting is to actually find out what your rhythm of flow is throughout the day. Mm-hmm. If you were willing to wear, you know, a brain sensing wearable for a few days, we could tell you, you know, whether you're more likely to get into flow at 4 p.m. every day, for example.
Well, I know I'd like to wear that.
Right? So for example, your ability to get into flow does vary throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And it also varies depending on how much sleep you've had mm-hmm. and how stressed you are in general.
So you do need to have multiple engagements, or at least you're wearing it multiple days to sort of see how, if you slept 7 hours, great 7 hours, or you didn't, and maybe have other activities and stresses and other things that impact.
Yeah, so maybe at the beginning you'll not see any pattern, but then, you know, say you realize that you have to have a more healthy sleep pattern, and you try and not be so stressed or whatever it is, you eat regularly and all that sort of stuff, and then you try again, you might actually start seeing more of a pattern. And that why, it's actually related to multiple things in the body. One is, it seems that there's an inverse relationship between something called cortisol, or arousal states, as they call it, and flow. So cortisol is not a bad thing, right? It is what wakes you up in the morning, and like a shot and a burst of it in the morning. But too much of it basically is what then causes stress. So literally, the more cortisol you have, you might get more flow, and then suddenly it'll start going down again. So it basically looks like an upside down V. Right? And so imagine if you have a constant low level form of stress, that's, you're not going to reach your full flow, for example, right? That's just one example. However, say you're trained in flow. Some other research has started to show that, say you were put into more stress, you'll be more able to deal with it, you know, be more resilient. But probably you need to have kind of had that experience of being in flow in the first place, you know? But it's starting to suggest that. So cortisol is also related to circadian rhythm. Right? So you have different levels of it throughout the day. Hence, you would have different times of the day that you're probably more likely to get into flow. So, you know, if it's at 4 p.m., you shouldn't be doing your emails then. You should be trying to do your deep work and your deep thinking, you know? For you, you mentioned 5:30 in the morning. That's cool. Great. No distractions. That's when you're going to do your writing, right? So that's some form of self-awareness and self-quantification. That it might take people years to find out on their own, right? I mean, experimenting and blah, blah, blah. But if you have some data, the idea is to help you more.
And that's what your neurocrate is trying to uncover as well.
That's one of the other sort of use cases that we're thinking about. So we've got these two components to our eventual flow platform, essentially. They work on their own. They work together. You know, that's the idea.
So tell us when people should start contacting you and try to plug in your software into their systems and into their companies.
Yeah, actually, we're already ready with the brainstorming tool. So, you know, it's available as a cloud-enabled piece of software. All you'd need to do is download it, and we'll
give. Where do you get it?
From me.
How do I get me?
So I have a website, neurocreate.co.uk. There's a slash creative where you can actually go and see how this brainstorming tool works. You can email me if you like after that, and that's shama@neurocreate.co.uk. Or it's rahman.shama@gmail.com. Harder to actually spell, but all
I'll
right.
I'll put in the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, you would just contact me directly. And we have different sort of offerings for enterprise level. We've got, you know, individual seats per month. We've also got site licenses. It would be super useful for anybody doing strategy, anybody creating new content. And that could be like games, or, you know, a new advert or a new design for a new product. It could be, I don't know, if you're a script writer or a songwriter. It could also be anybody trying to problem solve, you know, a hairy innovation topic or issue. So, you know, it's applicable within corporates and business as much as it's applicable with creative industries.
So if you want to boost your creativity, go visit these sites. I'll put them in the show notes. Shama, thank you for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure to have you on. Great energy, and look forward to staying in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for having listened to this recording of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find the show notes and other blog posts on MinterDial.com. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes to give a rating and review. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man. A convinced man building it.
of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I want to tell you about my podcast called Can I Offer You Some Feedback? I'm a business consultant and executive coach with over 20 years experience in change management, leadership development, and naturally providing feedback to high performers. My podcast is for those of you who have a complicated relationship with feedback, whether giving, receiving, avoiding, or seeking. Feedback is essential for our development. In each episode, you'll hear from real people across industries with their ideas, perspectives, and best practices on feedback. I'll also be sharing business bites with you, simple explanations of organizational tools, management techniques, and leadership philosophies that will help you and your businesses thrive. You can listen to Can I Offer You Some Feedback on your favorite podcast app or learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com.